Good morning. Can you hear me okay? Very happy to be with you this morning. I'm glad you ventured out in the rain. I also want to thank you for forming this kind of group where women can really empower and encourage other women. You know, we're going to talk today about feminine genius, but it's so important that women in their love of Jesus, their interior receptivity, can go out and help those fragile, wounded souls, build them up, and then bring them to the Eucharist and so on. So thank you for being a part of all this. Okay, so talking about femininity is becoming increasingly more complicated, not less, right? On the one hand, we all want to advocate for women's rights. We want women's dignity to be respected in all ways. But we live in a society that many times claims that to be for women's rights, you have to be for women's reproductive rights, which of course includes contraception and abortion and so on. There's a contradiction there, because women are often called to the vocation of motherhood. And in motherhood, God entrusts her with a child. So you would think it would be natural for women to be involved with the defense of children, both born and unborn, that should be directly aligned with a woman's vocation and with women's rights. Advocating for women also requires that women be treated equally in the workplace and so on. And clearly, women and men image God equally. So that makes perfect sense. Yet, many claim that this equality requires us to understand men and women in a way where we see no difference. They're equal and absolutely the same. And this doesn't make sense either. When you talk about the reproductive system, it's not something outside of our identity. It's something that's part of who we are, right? It's not just like frosting you add to the cake. Different cake, different frosting, and so on. Or same cake, different frosting. It's a built-in capacity to carry a child. That's got to alter one's self-perception, right? And then when one actually carries a child in the womb, that's an identity-changing event, right? So in our environment, it's very difficult to speak about how men and women complement one another, and it's a bit like walking on eggshells. It can be volatile even, right? In fact, it's very tempting just to deny that there's any difference. It makes the conversation much easier, right? But science supports that there's more differences between men and women than mere reproduction. Science is learning more and more about men and women's brains. Now, the structure is very similar, but the wiring is different. So for men, there's a lot more wiring that goes from the front to the back. And that helps a lot with eye-hand coordination, video games, throwing a ball like a girl. Never liked that one, but hammer and nail, you know. Women tend to have more wiring that goes back and forth from the left to the right. And so it can connect easily with logical thinking and emotional intelligence. That explains a lot, doesn't it? It can explain why women have a kind of intuition. It's very easy for them to empathize with others and so on. Now, we shouldn't think of these as really limiting factors. People can grow in gifts and develop, and there's, of course, individual differences. Our own Dr. Finley here is teaching a course where he's done some research on the differences between men and women's eyes. Men's eyes are better at tracking. Women's eyes are better at discriminating color. That explains why I'm looking at all these paint chips and agonizing over them. My husband says, it's all green. You know? So we're different beyond just the reproductive system. The movie industry understands the difference. They market some films as chick flicks, you know, undying love, personal relationships. Other movies have trailers that show car chases and explosions. They get it. They know who's buying, right? What we find too are comedians can give us an insight into this. While the rest of us are tiptoeing around eggshells, comedians can tell many jokes about the differences of men and women. You know, things where men want to control the remote. If something's lost in the house, it's the woman who finds it, as though we're a tracking device. Honey, where's my shirt, right? Also, have you heard the joke about packing? You know, when a woman packs for a trip, right? She's starting days in advance. She has many lists and to-do lists and so on. The man starts packing 5 minutes before departure, right? And you know, of course, if you know of a woman who can pack in 5, 15, 30 minutes, ask her to give me some pointers, because she's probably got an amazing list, you know? So comedians can get away with this, and sometimes they dwell on stereotypes, and we don't all fit into those stereotypes. But our laughter indicates a kind of recognition that there's maybe some truth to it. But it doesn't help us to see these differences clearly. And so we're going to turn to St. John Paul II and Edith Stein, eventually St. Teresa Benedict of the Cross, to give us some clarity. And first of all, the Church's answer to this is that men and women are equal in dignity, but different in ways that complement one another. Pope John Paul II gives us this starting point. We must consider the consequences of the Creator's decision that a human being should always exist as a man or a woman. And that's on your sheets, right? The consequences of the Creator's decision that the human being should always exist as a man or as a woman. So the question remains, what's the difference? Theology of the body, if we were to boil it down to something very simple, right? Theology of the body presents it in this way. There's a particular design to the body that indicates something about our psyche and something about our spirituality. So, women's bodies are set up in such a way that they are capable of making room for another. Right? Physically, we're able to make room for another in a way a man simply can't. And psychologically and spiritually, we are made up in such a way as to make room for one another. Now this wiring thing is starting to make sense, right? That logical intelligence and that, you know, emotional intelligence coming together. It all seems to make sense in the one package. So we all image God as individuals. But in the sacrament of marriage, that communion of love images the divine communion of persons, the Trinity. The union of man and woman is a way of imitating in the flesh the Creator's generosity and fecundity. That's from the Catechism. This means that just as our own existence is the result of God's abundant love, so too are children born of the love of their parents, right? Marriage is a kind of love that begets life, unlike other kinds of friendships, right? And so too, God's love begets life. In the Dignity and Vocation of Women, John Paul II speaks of women's role in this way, her role in self-giving in this way. This mutual gift of the person in marriage opens to the gift of a new life, a new human being. Motherhood implies from the beginning a special openness to a new person. This is precisely the woman's part. And in this openness, in conceiving and giving birth to a child, the woman discovers herself through a sincere gift of self, the gift of interior readiness. To accept the child and bring it into the world is linked to this marriage union. Later on in St. John Paul II's writings, the end of his life, he takes this point even a bit further. He says, womanhood denotes motherhood. And motherhood is the first form of entrustment of one person to another. Let's repeat that. Motherhood is the first form of entrustment of one person to another. That the first time a human person is entrusted to the world, God gives it to a mother. The design, this is God's design. It has meaning, right? And so he also says in the Dignity and Vocation of Women that motherhood is linked to the personal structure of the woman, to that personal dimension of the gift. So this is part of who we are. This isn't like frosting on the cake where you can just change the frosting, right? Now, he goes on to say that although both man and woman together are parents of their child, get this, the woman's motherhood constitutes a special part in this shared parenthood. And the most demanding part, it is the woman who pays directly for the shared generation. Thank goodness someone says that, right? Pregnancy's hard. It literally absorbs the energies of her body and soul. So, we're not mere incubators. When we carry a child, it absorbs all of who we are, and it changes us, right? And it affects our whole person. So this gift is a deeply personal gift. And he says it's necessary that the man be fully aware that their shared parenthood, he owes woman a special debt. And no program of equal rights between women and men is valid unless it takes that into account. So, when we find, through natural motherhood, women's bodies are thoroughly transformed and changed forever in pregnancy, gestation, birth, lactation. We're the first to feel the baby kick. We have to be attentive to everything we put in our mouths. You know, will this help the baby? Will this, oh, I can't have wine, you know, all that. All of this is identity changing, right? So JP2 describes pregnancy in this way. The motherhood involves a special communion with the mystery of life. And as the child develops in the mother's womb, the mother's filled with wonder at this mystery of life. And she understands it with a unique intuition about what's happening inside of her. The mother accepts and loves as a person this child she's carrying in her womb. There's this unique contact with this new human being that's developing. And along the way, it gives her a rise to new attitudes regarding other human beings, right? That mother can't feed her child. I feel her pain. What can we do for her, right? It changes how you look at the world. Not only towards her child, but to the whole human family, right? It profoundly marks her personality. It's commonly thought that women are more capable of paying attention to another person. Motherhood develops this predisposition even more. And the man, in all of his sharing of parenthood, of all the sharing of, you know, trying to support his wife through a pregnancy, say, he always remains outside of the process of pregnancy. And in many ways, he has to learn his own fatherhood from the mother. Let's think about this for a second. He learns his fatherhood from mother. So she has this gift of interior readiness to receive the other. And she responds to this gift. And he learns, and in some way, he appropriates the gift. But he doesn't appropriate it in a way that becomes mother. He appropriates it in a way that becomes father. And this becomes important when we talk about men and women's gifts later on. We can learn from one another. Yeah, right? And we can appropriate one another's gifts. But just because we appropriate the masculine gift, it doesn't make us more masculine. If a man appropriates the woman's gift, it doesn't somehow make him woman. We can learn from one another. We can appropriate. We should learn from one another. But we don't cease to be man and woman when we do that. Okay? So the child's upbringing as a whole should include, of course, the contribution of both parents. And although the mother's contribution is decisive in laying out this foundation, of course we need those strong fathers in there. So what John Paul II is saying is that women have this gift of interior readiness to accept the other, this interior receptivity. And we're predisposed to this. Pregnancy, birth are one way of developing it further. But the gift isn't developed exclusively in natural motherhood, right? Think of all the women who are, you know, in our school system who may lovingly care for children when the parents aren't there. You know, Johnny, eat some crackers, it'll settle your stomach, and then go ahead and take your math test. You'll be fine. You know, all those women who are part of that process, right? They inform the parents of a problem. Think of all the women in healthcare who deliver treatment in ways that are so empathetic and so sensitive. Women are predisposed to this gift, and they can develop it in many ways, through their professions, through adoptive motherhood, through many forms of spiritual motherhood. So, for instance, with regard to spiritual motherhood, it's not uncommon to refer to women religious as mother, in the case of Mother Teresa, right? That's a profound sort of motherhood. Also, JP2 addresses adoptive families. And here he says, adopting children, regarding and treating them as one's own children, means recognizing the relationship between parents and children is not measured only by genetic standards. Procreative love is first and foremost a gift of self. There is a form of procreation which occurs through the acceptance, concern, and devotion. So the resulting relationship is so intimate and enduring that it is no way inferior to one based on a biological connection. So women are designed in such a way to have this interior receptivity. Natural motherhood is a great way to develop that. It's certainly not the only way. Okay. So, but what happens to this receptivity in a fallen world? In a fallen world, receptivity makes you vulnerable, right? And so John Paul addresses this when he talks about the Garden of Eden. And when Adam and Eve sin, this sin brings apart a break in this original unity between man and woman. And this affects our unity with God, of course. The fall in the Garden of Eden, in some ways, has more serious consequences for the woman. I'm quoting him there, right? It leads to domination. So when we hear in Genesis 3, he shall rule over you, this is not a part of the good creation. This is the result of sin, the effects of sin. Domination takes place of what should have been that sincere gift of self within the relationship of men and women. Oppression threatens that fundamental equality between men and women. And this kind of sin leads to a domination of women, and thus it suppresses her gifts. So Jesus comes to us to rescue us from this fallen state. And in Dignity and Vocation of Women, John Paul II spends a lot of time talking about how Jesus treated women. He turns us to Scripture. And here he says, he talks about a gospel innovation. Jesus is very countercultural in his interactions with women. He promotes their true dignity and vocation, sometimes to the point of scandal. So in Luke, we find women, Jesus showing women love and honor in spite of their sin. And if you remember the story of the Pharisee, invites Jesus in, and this sinful woman goes to anoint the feet of Jesus with perfumed oil. She's at his feet. She begins to wet his feet with her tears. She wipes his feet with her hair. She kisses them. She pours perfume on them. And the Pharisee, trying to test Jesus here, says, you know, if this man were a prophet, you'd know what kind of woman she is. Jesus senses that he's saying this in response to a story. There's two men who owe money. One owes a greater sum, one a lesser sum. Both debts are forgiven. Who's more grateful? Well, okay, the guy who owed more money, right? Jesus says, you haven't provided water for my feet. You didn't give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I've entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not pour oil on my head. She's poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever's been forgiven little loves little. So here we see in the gospel that the sinful woman becomes a model of faith right? Because of her receptivity to Jesus and because of his power to transform her. The Pharisee, on the other hand, is not the model of faith. And of course, this would be countercultural. Jesus commends women for their courage and faith throughout the Gospels. For instance, in Mark, we find the woman who has that flow of blood. She's exhausted her savings with doctors. She touches Jesus' garment when, you know, they're in the middle of this crowd and she's instantly cured. Jesus wants to know who touched him, right? She's fearful. She begins to tremble. She's afraid she's made him impure. And she's fearing that he's going to be mad at her. He says, "Daughter, your faith has cured you. Go in peace, free of your illness." She's gutsy, she's receptive, and that changes the whole dynamic, right? Oh, Jesus is able to change her. The Canaanite woman. So this is a woman who's a non-Jew, and she has the audacity to be crying out to Jesus, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter's demon-possessed and suffering terribly." Jesus doesn't say anything, and the disciples send her away, get rid of her, right? And Jesus finally answers and says, "My mission is only to the lost sheep of Israel. It's not right to take the food of the sons and daughters and throw it to the dogs." But she insists, "Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table." Jesus, now, note here, she's challenging Jesus. Not like the Pharisee, who's challenging from a position of disbelief. She's challenging him from a position of faith. And being the perfect man, he's not at all intimidated by this, right? He says to her, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted," and her daughter was healed in that moment. She has great faith, great receptivity. The Samaritan woman at the well in the Gospel of John. First of all, they marveled that he was talking to a woman. All right, so he's stunning people all over the place by his treatment of women. And this woman is at the well at noontime. Now, why would you go to the well at the time of day when it's the hottest? Because you don't want to meet everybody else. You don't want to hear their gossip. You don't want their glares and stares and so on. So she obviously doesn't feel welcome. And she's puzzled that this Jew would ask a Samaritan for water. And so he begins to tell her about living water, and they have a conversation about this, and she becomes very interested. And then he tells her the secrets of her life. "You've had 5 husbands, and the one you're with now isn't your husband," and so on. So he explains all these things to her, explains that he's the Messiah. She believes him. And now this woman, who didn't even dare to go to the well when other people are there, dares to go back to town and say, "You've got to meet this guy. He's the Messiah. He knew everything about me. Come on, you got to meet him." And the whole town is converted. Now think about this. This woman, who is far from perfect, she's receptive to Jesus. He transforms her, and she becomes an evangelist in a way. She evangelizes this whole village. And brings about the conversion of others. In Christ's passion and resurrection, we really see here the interior receptivity of women. In the Gospels, we see that women are at the forefront and at the foot of the cross. We see they're the first at the tomb. They're the first to hear he is risen. In the Gospel of John, Mary Magdalene is the first eyewitness to the risen Lord, and is often referred to as the apostle to the apostles. She finds the empty tomb. She goes and tells the disciples. And if you remember, that's when Peter and the beloved disciple have that race to the tomb, right? They find the tomb empty, but Mary stays. And at first, Mary mistakes Jesus as the gardener. But then she finally recognizes him. And he says, "Go tell my brothers." So Christ entrusts this divine truth to her first, and then has her go and prepare the brothers. Think of how often that happens in, you know, our lives, where we see the mom or the wife dragging everyone else to church, you know? Having this interior readiness and then and then trying to promote it in others. Now, JP2 is very clear that just because women may have this interior readiness, we're not saying that they're more capable of love. Okay? There's an essential equality of men and women. They're equally capable of receiving the outpouring of divine truth, equally capable of receiving the Holy Spirit, equally capable of responding to Jesus' love. What we do see here is the women have this readiness to make room for Jesus and prepare the brothers. And once the apostles are on board, they pick up the ball and they run with it. And they're willing to lay down their lives for the gospel. So there's no room to talk about superiority here, right? So JP2 says that this interior readiness has an impact on the rest of society. Women, of course, if they're predisposed to make room for another, they can first learn and then teach others that human relations are not authentic if they do not begin with accepting the other person as loved and dignified simply because they're a human person. They're not lovable simply because they're useful or beautiful or intelligent or strong or healthy. And this is a fundamental contribution women give to the church and to the world. GP2 goes on to talk about in Evangelium Vitae how important this is for cultural change, to move from a culture of death to a civilization of love, this influence of the woman. Some may accuse JP2 as suggesting that a woman's place is only in the home. This is not true. On the one hand, there's a very important role for the mother in the home. It's critical to the stability and growth of the family. But, of course, husbands and fathers take on enormously important family responsibilities as well. So that's not the case. And, in fact, JP2 says the women's gifts are desperately needed outside of the home. He insists that the world has a great need for these gifts. And when women are prevented from offering these gifts, not only the women themselves, but society as a whole is impoverished. Without the contribution of women, society is less alive, culture is impoverished, peace is less stable. So we find often in society that it's tempted to narrow solutions, narrow efficiency. And in narrow efficiency, sometimes we try to accomplish something in a strictly economic way that lets go of other values that are extremely important. So solving problems guided by rules of profit or what have you. And then other important values get neglected. Women's involvement, JP2 says, can offer a correction to this. So in solving problems in society such as social services, migration, problems of education, the elderly, drugs, the presence of women is extremely valuable. It will force systems to be redesigned in a way that favors a process of humanization, which can mark the civilization of love. So society should be organized in such a way that enables women to participate in public life. Society should facilitate the participation of women in public life in ways that allows time for them to take care of those obligations in the home. Now let's move a bit to Edith Stein. And that was her name when she was a philosopher, raised as a Jew, but had chosen atheism. Eventually becomes converted, and she, during World War II, a colleague of hers died, and she went to comfort the widow. And the widow had this phenomenal belief in the resurrection. Here she went to comfort the widow, and the widow comforted her because of her belief in the resurrection. And she's staying with friends, and one night she reads the autobiography of St. Teresa of Avila. St. Teresa of Avila, St. Teresa, Benedict of the Cross, right? It's a foundational, pivotal moment for her. She reads the book, and one night, intense person, closes it and says, "This is the truth." She goes on to become Catholic, and then eventually Carmelite, and eventually a saint and martyr. She's helpful to us here. She and JP2 have a sort of intellectual heritage. And while JP2 talks about the genius of women, I think he likes women. And also, I think he appreciates the fact that women's gifts have gone unnoticed in history. She dwells more on the complementary side. How do women's gifts and men's gifts complement one another? So, first of all, Edith Stein or St. Teresa and John Paul II, when they speak about the gifts of men and women, always display a reverence for the uniqueness of the individual. God created us as unique individuals. That's to be accepted and celebrated. So that's first. But to say that women in general have certain tendencies and men have other tendencies does not mean at all that women are simply all alike or men are all alike. And just because a particular woman may display certain gifts that we associate with the masculine, I mean, think of all those women saints who were on this missions that required great courage of them. They don't become less feminine. They don't become less womanly. She has these gifts, but she performs them as a woman. So we can accept our uniqueness as a part of God's design. There's no cookie cutters here. There's no stereotypes to confine us, right? And one of the important gifts women have to offer to the world is their openness to other human beings, how to make room for another. Stein, as we said, how to pay attention to that whole person that stands in front of them. For Stein, men tend to be more task-oriented, more focused. You remember I said Mary Magdalene was so receptive to Jesus, she was the first to witness the risen Lord. The men picked up the ball and ran with it, more task-oriented, right? But Stein warns us that with the gifts that men and women have, there's also vulnerabilities. Every gift that you have, say it's an intellectual gift, if you have an intellectual gift, it always runs the risk of being deformed if it's not formed correctly. So every gift can be abused, and so as women, although we can be open to relation with one another, we can also abuse those relationships. That explains, you know, when I talk to people about this, they say, what about, women are so relational, what about mean girls? You know, the phenomenon of mean girls, and then those some women who don't grow out of that mean girl stage, right? They exist. And we see a real difference between male and female bullying. With men, it's usually physical, or it's certainly obvious. With women, it can be relational and possessive and that sort of thing. And the point is that when the gift becomes corrupt, they're very good at manipulating. Very good, right? Women can be preoccupied with self-interest. They can become attuned to their own vanity. They can be really curious regarding other people in ways that are indiscreet, in ways that are invasive. They just want to know because they just want to know. This is a corruption of the gift. It's very different when you pay attention to the other person with the hope to serve them. It's another thing to be invasively curious, right? And the remedy for women is the male counterpart, work, right? For the women who might tend to be invasively curious or focused on their vanity, the natural remedy is good, solid, objective, meaningful work. It doesn't have to be work that pays. It has to be meaningful work. So when you think of the celebrities, the women celebrities that are famous for being beautiful and going to all the right parties, but they don't really have any kind of job or work, this is corruptive for any human being, right? We have to have a reason to get up and do, right? We have to have a mission. So the task focus serves as a way of directing the woman's gift, preserving the woman's gift, forming the woman's gift. Men, we set our task focused. It could be business or art. It could be producing things. It could be scholarship. Men's weakness here is that the task can become too focused, too narrow. We talk about narrow efficiency, right? That means that other values are put aside and lost. So, you know, if a man is on a particular mission and he has a very focused attitude to what is going to accomplish this mission, and he's not attentive to the other people around giving advice, he's not going to be able to shape the mission in a way that's truly effective. Of course, what is the complement to this? Relationality, right? And so I think these differences can be strongest for us in young adulthood. And I think as we grow in good friendships with members of the opposite sex, often we can appropriate these other gifts in ways that actually protect and form our own gift. So you can also see why it's so important for children to have mothers and fathers, because they can help these gifts grow and develop in ways that are positive. Now, of course, each soul is created by God and given a particular character. We have to appreciate the individuality of each soul and their special vocation from God. And she has, as an educator, she has advice of how to be attentive to the differences between boys and girls. She stands firmly against tendencies in an education system that prepare young women merely, solely for married life. Of course, with the Third Reich, she denounces this, what was literally a breeding program of Aryan stock. She insists that the young women should be trained for options, married life, religious life, single life. They need math and science to develop abstract thought and rational skills. She also perceives that young women tend to need a little nudge in growing independent from the home, because often they're very close to the home and they need their own sorts of independence. Sometimes if they're tied too closely, they can't develop in their own vocation. Boys, on the other hand, they're ready to bolt, right? They want independence. You give them the opposite. You gotta hold them back a little bit, because they need to become aware of all the gifts and all the style of family living. They have to learn the ways of family life. They can't become overly competitive. We don't want them to become loners, right? So all these gifts require formation. So how can we develop this receptivity? How can we grow in the faith? How can we support one another? Well, of course, you're doing that by being here. That's why I started on that note, that this is a beautiful group to belong to. But I suggest one more route if you're not already, maybe you're already doing this. You might want to cultivate the friendship of women saints. Yeah, women saints. Become familiar with women saints. Now, one of the books I have on the back of your sheet is Benedict's on Holy Women. There's about 17 women saints there, if that helps you get interested in a particular saint. Choose one that you can relate to, right? And maybe read her biography or her letters. And I don't think we have to be like St. Teresa Benedict of the Cross and read Avila in one night. I don't know how she does it. She's really intense. What we can do is read them gradually. And, you know, frankly, that's usually how we grow in friendship, right? We learn to know a person gradually. So, and let them mentor us. I have another book on that list for you by Colleen Campbell, My Sisters the Saints, right? Let them mentor us. Let them help us to be sensitive to those frail souls, those wounded souls. As Mother Teresa says, you go out into the holes, into those dark places, and you bring Christ's light there. And you know, we're naturally aware of people and sensitive to people. You know, maybe you're at the doctor's office, or maybe you're at the food court, and you see that someone gets the tragic news that someone, a beloved person in their life, has just died. Maybe it's a friend of yours, maybe it's a stranger, right? And if they start naturally talking with you, and you can talk about maybe maybe you lost a loved one 2 years ago, you know, and you're talking about it, one thing we can do with them is offer to pray with them. You know, it's one thing to say, I'll pray for you and walk away, and sometimes that's what you have to do, but it's grand if you can say, do you want to pray now? Right? And it's particularly easy if they're Christian, and maybe they're going to want to hold your hand, and you can ask them, do you want to start or should I? You know, and often a person's in a frail moment, maybe they'll want you to start. You could start with something simply as, dear Lord Jesus, help this family. And the Holy Spirit will carry the prayer from there. You don't have to plan it, you know? The Holy Spirit can do that. But this is how Mother Teresa saw her role, as bringing light to those who were in darkness. And so this interior receptivity, even like the woman at the well, right? If we cultivate it carefully, we can lead others to Christ. Thank you.